Hello, and welcome to The Alt Left.
Welcome back, everybody, to this episode of The Alt Left in its entirety for once. It is episode 13. We are recording at the end of February on the 24th of 2021. I'm your host, Chris. With me, as always, is the good Reverend Dr. K.
Good evening, everyone.
And Matthew Tripod Smith.
Hello and welcome back, everyone.
We are back after some hiatus. Last week, obviously, all we had for you was the hot take because we kind of recorded this episode. And before editing, it was totally corrupted. Super fun times, right?
Oh, yeah, it was great.
So, but it's okay. We pulled K back from the ledge. He made it, and we're going to go ahead and do an actual episode. And today we're going to be talking about the war on drugs. Let's talk about this war on drugs, because there's one thing to talk about: drug prevention, drug treatment, drug criminalization. That's not unique. Every culture around the world has had to deal with this, from progressive-minded, you know, Western European socialistic attitudes to highly, highly authoritarian cultures like China. In the Middle East, every culture and every landed people have had to deal with what they feel is the answer to drug abuse and drug use.
Well, I mean, it's kind of interesting. It's like almost as if once you've solved the problem of food, water, and shelter, the next two things human beings want to do is fuck and get fucked up.
I mean, that sounds like a good time to me.
I mean, to be fair, koalas spend their entire day high. Eucalyptus straight from the tree gets them completely baked. But the idea of having a war on an ideal, you know, it's pretty damn American. I mean, we're the ones who had a war on communism and a war on drugs. Now I've got a war on terror. I mean, we love having wars against adjectives.
Yeah, and they never end well.
No.
At all.
No,
anyone.
It's hard to kill an adjective.
Yep.
So I kind of wanted to start us off with going through kind of a timeline, because if we're going to talk about this thing, I want to go into where it came from, what it consisted of, what its actual motivations were, who brought it in, where it went wrong, blah, blah, blah. Like, let's define terms, right?
Hit me hard, so, Chrissy Poo.
So, well, everything starts in 1969, right? Summer of Love, right? This is Woodstock.
Yep.
In 69, Nixon, in a message to Congress, identifies drug abuse as, and his quote was, a serious national threat. And in this message, he basically cited a big jump in drug-related juvenile arrests and street crime between 1960 and 1967. So he basically took this block of 7 years and said, this is all drugs' fault. And he called for a national anti-drug policy at the state and federal level, a joint policy. And this is the first time this has ever happened. The closest we've ever had to that was prohibition. But that was a constitutional amendment. It didn't last, and it wasn't nearly as comprehensive as this. This is a massive intergovernmental regulatory agency and set of laws he's talking about proposing. And then in 71, 2 years later, he officially declares his war on drugs. He's the first to use that term. Most people kind of attribute it to the Reagan era, but it was Nixon that did this. And he identified drug use as public enemy number one. Again, he came up with these terms.
So keep in mind, folks, that's going to be 40 years this June since the war on drugs was first declared.
And so this idea of like public enemy number one, there's a reason this fits a term. And this is from, you know, remember, this is the J. Edgar Hoover days. You know, this guy had a rampant FBI that was an enemy of the American public and has kind of continued to be so ever since. And so public enemy number one became this thing that Americans are doing and that all humans tend to do. 2 years later, again, in 73 now, Nixon actually creates the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. And this coordinates all the efforts of agency, federal and state. Kind of like now we have Homeland Security, coordinates intelligence, police, and federal agencies all together. Everything kind of funnels through Homeland Security. Same kind of thing. He creates this DEA to handle everything drug related. From the get-go, this was not something that started out altruistic. This did not start out as policy to help the American people. This had a very clear intention from day one. This was not a good policy that went bad. Journalist Dan Baum over a decade ago, actually almost 20 years ago, I think it was like 50, it was like 99 or something like that. Anyway, Dan Baum, well over a decade ago, interviewed the senior Nixon aide, John Ehrlichman, before he died, about the war on drugs.
Oh, and wait. I remember this. Is this where he just comes out and admits everything?
Yep. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And people had talked about this. People had said Nixon said these things. Like, this was not a revelation that no one knew happened, but it had never come from a reliable source. And so, again, this is John Ehrlichman. This is one of the top senior aides Nixon had the entire time. This guy was at Nixon's hip. And his quote here is, it's chilling. The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies. The anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. That's a quote from the White House, man.
Wow.
And again, remember, people on the right will still try to claim these bullshit claims like racism is over. This was 1971. This is 40 years ago. Okay. There are people that were born when this happened that are not even, that are middle-aged now. This is not like hundreds of years ago. And this kind of shit still goes on today. You know, just because our government leaders aren't out there dropping N-bombs right and left doesn't mean they're not racist asshats. And Nixon was one of their kings.
The idea of the White House saying an enemy is someone who's against their war, that's scary enough that the White House considers a portion of the American people an enemy for holding a political belief. But even that, you can have a legitimate argument like, well, what do you think about terrorism or fundamentalism or blah, blah, blah. They said their enemy was also black people, which, again, anyone who's a person of color in this country is going to hear that and go, duh. But to hear the president outright say, like, man, if I could just get rid of all the black people. You haven't heard that since Lincoln said that.
Yeah.
Also, not the hero you think he is, but that's a different podcast. So anyway, so that's through our 70s, is Nixon creates this DEA to heavily criminalize marijuana to get rid of hippies and anti-war protesters, and heavily criminalize heroin to nail people of color in the country and get them to put away for crazy long prison terms. So then that brings us out of the Nixon era and into the 80s, which most people are actually that's where the war on drugs gets just bonkers fucked up. And that's why most people think of the 80s when they think of the war on drugs. So in 82, Panamanian leader General Manuel Noriega, he allows Pablo Escobar to ship cocaine through Panama into the United States. We'll talk shortly how that happened. But Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush, right, combines agents from all these different agencies and military branches to form this thing he calls the South Florida Drug Task Force. And Miami, because Miami is the main entry point. So he forms this extra task force in Florida to nail these coke boats. Now, remember here, as we go through this, this is before George Bush is president. This is when George H.W. Bush is vice president. And before then, he was director of the CIA in charge of Latin America and the drug trade. This guy knows what he's doing. Good or bad, whatever you want to assign his motives, he's no moron. Okay? This guy is calculating. Unlike his son, George H.W. Bush is intelligent, he is methodical, and he has a plan.
And so, motivated.
Yeah.
100%.
So Bush creates this Florida task force to kind of stop Pablo Escobar, which, again, if you don't know who Pablo Escobar is, just look him up. The guy was one of the richest human beings who lived at that point. I mean, just made such fortunes off drug trade, owned countries. Like, Pablo Escobar is just, there's just no go. It's a whole long thing to go into, but just know that he's the guy who invented being a drug kingpin, and he did it better than anyone in history.
On him alone.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, so this guy, Pablo Escobar, he gets elected to the Colombian Congress. Now, here's your problem. So your public enemy number one is now a politician. And he gained support, but he built low-income housing. He would just dole out money into the slums. He would walk through and just fork out wheelbarrows of money. He built hospitals. He built roads. He built kind of like what Hezbollah does now in Palestine. He built infrastructure for the poor, and so everyone loved him. He even campaigned with Catholic priests building churches and stuff. He got driven out of Congress the next year by the Minister of Justice, but that was long enough for him to totally weaken extradition laws between the U.S. So now, a couple years later, 84 is when Nancy Reagan launches her very famous Just Say No campaign.
Oh, God.
Which doesn't do anything, but that's where we are. That's where we are in 1984.
Isn't that what DARE started, too?
Yes. Shortly after, but yes.
It was a pet project, too, wasn't it? It was like Just Say No led right into DARE.
Yeah, where they got to put all their cops who couldn't stay sober or not beat people into pasture was the DARE program. Yep. Anyway, so because of that.
Successful.
Yeah, right. So Nancy Reagan is doing that front, and Vice President Bush has his South Florida drug task force, right? And it's actually pretty effective. Like, they're seizing cocaine boats, they're doing all kinds of stuff. But because of this, the answer to that is not to get sneakier with their boats, just stop coming to Florida. Which is just genius. I just love that story where they were like, oh, all right, it's going to be a whole lot easier for us to move than them to move the military. So they just moved to Mexico and the Mexican border.
Why not, right?
Yeah. And the Mexican border is way harder to patrol. It's way bigger. And it's way easier to get shit over a land border than it is to sail a Coke boat into a harbor. So this works out great for them. So the Mexican border becomes the major point of entry for Coke headed into the United States. And it has been to this day. So then 86, right? Reagan signs the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986. It appropriates $1.7 billion to fight the drug war. And this is in 86 money. Think about what $1.7 billion in 1986 could have done to healthcare and drug treatment in this country. Instead, we use it to round people up. The bill creates mandatory minimum penalties for drug offenses. That's the first time that had happened for drug uses. And creates huge racial disparities in the prison population because, well, the differences in sentencing for crack and powder cocaine are different. Now, possession of crack, which is way cheaper, has a harsher sentence than possession of cocaine, which is more expensive, harder to get, and a harder drug. But that's because wealthy white people use cocaine and poor people of color are more likely to use crack at this time in New York and Los Angeles. And all of a sudden, we now have mandatory minimums. So if you get arrested for something and if you get found guilty, the judge has no choice. If there's a mandatory minimum sentence of 30 years, you're going away for it. The judge cannot be like, yeah, but this was literally a kid who had dust on his shoe. Like, maybe. Nope. Doesn't matter. It's a mandatory minimum sentencing. This is something later that Bill Clinton would get a lot of flack for, too, for continuing this. But so we already have from get-go, crack is heavily vilified, heavily litigated against, and heavily put people away for, where cocaine is just kind of let to go. So now, the next year, 87, right? Carlos Lader is captured by the Colombian National Police, and he's extradited to the United States. And for those of you who don't know your Bush doctrine history, Carlos Lader was the Colombian drug lord and co-founder of the Medellin cartel. So he's kind of a smaller, he's kind of a right-hand man to Pablo Escobar. Same kind of deal. Anyway, he's convicted of drug smuggling and sentenced to life in prison without parole. He gets life without parole and 135 years. So life sentence plus 135 years. And then he was released from prison after 33 years in 2020, actually last year. He was released in exchange because he did a testimony against Manuel Noriega. Noriega is an infamous in American politics. He's the authoritarian ruler of Panama at this time. And he was even bigger than Escobar. He amassed such a fortune that, and it was all through drug trafficking into the U.S. He was basically king of Panama. Now, later we found out that after these records were released by the CIA, we found out that he had a longstanding tie to the CIA before the invasion of Panama removed him. In the 50s, Noriega actually worked with U.S. CIA and became one of the most valued intelligence sources. His MVP role was serving as a conduit for illegal weapons, military equipment, and cash destined for U.S.-backed forces throughout Latin America. This is from the CIA documents, by the way. Noriega received upwards of $100,000 per year from the 1960s until the 1980s, when his salary was increased to $200,000 per year.
Jesus Christ.
That's not what he was making from selling drugs. He was making millions from selling drugs. We were paying him a few hundred thousand dollars. The salary was laughably, it was justified because he was quote unquote helping the DEA curb the drug trade.
Of course.
Yes.
Curb it right back into the country. That's what he was doing.
Yep. Absolutely. So we were paying him to keep drugs out of the country as he was making a fortune putting drugs into the country. But because he was our CIA stool pigeon and was helping us distribute weapons, the CIA just let him go. But At this time, the war on drugs suddenly becomes bad PR for Latin American drug lords to be cozy to. And in March of 88, the U.S. went to negotiations for him to step down from power because the U.S. loves to demand what leaders are allowed to be in power of smaller nations, right?
Yep.
And his implication into the Iran-Contra scandal is why he suddenly came out of favor. If you don't know what the Iran-Contra scandal was, don't worry, everybody. It's complicated. It's super obscure by design. I promise we're going to circle back to that in a second. I'll give an easy breakdown. So at that same month, as we're talking about the U.S. trying to get Noriega out, right? Noriega's forces resisted a CIA-backed attempted coup against the government of Panama. This is all done in secret. As relations continue to deteriorate, Noriega basically shifted his alliance to the his Cold War alliance. Remember, this is the Cold War's raging. He shifts over to the Russians. Starts cozying up with the Soviet bloc. He starts receiving military aid from Cuba, Nicaragua, and Libya. After the coup failed, American military planners basically began preparing contingency plans just to outright invade Panama. October of 89, Noriega fails a second CIA coup attempt. And this is the CIA actually got his own Major Moises Girardi of the Panama military to actually try to take him out. And Noriega lives. He makes it. So, of course, this pressure mounts on Bush. This is when Bush is president now. Bush declared that the U.S. would not negotiate with drug traffickers and denied knowledge of Noriega's involvement with the drug trade prior to his 88 indictment, even though Bush had met with Noriega while he was director of the CIA and he had been the chair of the task force on drugs while he was vice president. He now says, I would never meet with him. So to do this, so the U.S. continuously has random troops floating around Panama. It's like an 80s version of the Pearl Harbor trap, right? Hoping something will go wrong. And eventually it worked. Several Marines were in civvies. They were in a civilian car because that doesn't sound like CIA wet work, right? just a few Marines in jeans and T-shirts and a Honda for some reason driving through enemy country.
Hanging out, having a good time, yeah. Doing some blow. I mean,
yeah, they got yanked out. One of them gets shot. And that was all the excuse needed to launch a totally full invasion. So the U.S. launches its invasion of Panama on, let's see, it's December 20th, 1989. And even though the killing of the Marine was the main reason, the official reason for the invasion, the operation had been planned for months before he was ever killed. A bombing campaign is how it kicked off. Let's see, we got stats here. Take out government buildings, and for some reason, a poor slum town where the U.N. estimated 500 civilians were bombed by the United States. So we got 23 U.S. soldiers and 845 Panamanian soldiers, plus those 500 civilians, and an additional 20,000 people lost their homes and became refugees, all for the bullshit excuse of one shady Marine. We completely invaded, took over the sovereign nation because one guy got shot.
America, fuck yeah!
And this is completely not just against what you would think is, I mean, this is in direct violation of international law that the U.S. wrote. And on the 29th of December of that same year, the UN General Assembly voted 75-20 to condemn the invasion as, quote, a flagrant violation of international law as it directly violates Article 2 of the UN Charter.
And did we immediately stop?
No. And if you look at Article 2, it basically states you're not allowed to go to war with any nation unless they've invaded you and it's in defense or the UN approves. You know, that's why we always make that show of trying to get UN approval before we go bomb some poor country, because either A, you have to be attacked, or B, the UN has to prove. We did neither. We absolutely 100% committed a war crime publicly.
Is that another reason? Is that another one of those reasons why we have bases all over the fucking world? So that when somebody attacks one of our bases, we can claim that they attacked us directly and that we can then claim that they made the first move.
I would say it's definitely icing on the cake, but I don't think that's any motivation. Because, I mean, if you look at the U.S., we've never needed that. I mean, Vietnam was started because they said the Vietnamese fired upon a gunboat that didn't even exist.
For the tangent.
No. If you look at most American foreign wars, they tend to be false flags or flagrantly accelerated bullshit.
Look, if we want to go to war somewhere, we're going to find a fucking reason to go to war. Like that's part of our history. Like we will always find an excuse to go to war. And if we can't find one, we'll make one up.
We went to war in Korea for no good reason. We went to Vietnam for a gunboat that didn't even exist. We got into World War II for Pearl Harbor that we basically begged the Japanese to come and take it after we cut them off from their world oil supply, giving Japan basically no choice but to go to war with us. World War I, the sinking of Lusitania, Germany took out like a one-page ad in the New York Times begging Americans to not get on this fucking boat because it's going to get torpedoed. And then it happened and we were like, what? How could you do that to us? Anyway, wartime. For the United States to get into a war for just reasons is an exception to the rule. That's just the history of our warfare. So anyway, so after this is all done, right? You know, the it doesn't take long. The Panamanian military surrenders very quickly to the U.S. after we just start bombing the shit out of them. Noriega's captured. He's flown to the U.S. He's tried, convicted, imprisoned, and after his sentence is finished, we actually extradited him to France, where they did the same thing all over again, and then extradited him to U.S.-controlled Panama and imprisoned him until he died of a brain tumor as an old man. Yeah, we tried him for his offenses, and then when he was done, we shipped him over to France so they could try him and sentence him, and then they shipped him back to his home country, Panama, which we then controlled, so we could jail him a second time.
Nice.
Yeah, so what does this have to do? Okay, so now we got the Iran-Contra, right? And what does that term mean? Most people have heard of the Iran-Contra, and for anybody who's listening, if you haven't heard of it or if you're not really quite sure, again, it's the CIA torched most of the documents when they were requested. These documents no longer exist anymore, so it's meant to be obscure. But what you need to know is there's a couple things happening in tandem, right?
And this is also, just so everyone's aware, there are many reasons to hate Ronald Reagan. This is just one in a large pile.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is probably one of his greatest. This is probably hands down his, you know, for me, it's a toss up as to whether or not the Iran-Contra is his greatest source of evil, or it's whether or not he dismissed AIDS as the gay flu.
Yeah.
But either way, anyone who defends Ronald Reagan.
Most recently, within the last 2 years, we just got recordings of him talking to Nixon and referring to black people as monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
That's a thing that happened too.
Yeah.
And then don't forget when he was governor of California, he basically is the one that's responsible for all of our massive amounts of homeless that have mental issues because he closed down literally every single California mental hospital there was.
And then his president did the same thing nationwide. He torched the National Institute of Mental Health. Yeah. Reagan is half the reason we have such a homeless problem in this country. So anyway, so his greatest in here, the Iran-Contra, right? So you got several wars and skirmishes going on at the same time. And I promise these far apart geopolitical struggles all have a tie, and it's the United States. So to start things off, and I promise I'll make this the Reader's Digest version of the Iran-Contra. Iran is in a horrifyingly bloody war with Iraq, right? And it's been going on for 8 years at this point. You know, one day we can do a modern Mideast war podcast, but all you need to know is the war consisted of terrorism, chemical weapons, trench and guerrilla warfare, massive artillery, air battles. The military death toll alone is over 1 million for the Iran-Iraq war. And this does not include the civilian death toll or the 100,000 Kurds that Saddam had eradicated in basically a pogrom or Holocaust. But just if you're talking about just combatants alone, it's over 1 million dead. And the reason this involves the U.S. is not oil for once. The U.S. was making a fortune selling weapons to Iran before the war. Iran and Iraq were basically the main split of Persia. They had wanted to conquer each other for a long time. War was kind of always coming. We were selling them a shit ton of weapons. But in 1979, Iranian nationalists and college students stormed the U.S. embassy, took a bunch of hostages, and kicked off what you've probably heard is called the Iranian hostage crisis. Some new controversial documents now show that Reagan was actually behind negotiating with these guys to hold off until the election was over to make Carter look weak. But again, why Ronald Reagan was an evil as fuck asshole is a podcast in itself we'll do one day. So anyway, once this crisis happened, Jimmy Carter, president in 1979, placed an embargo against selling any weapons to Iran. This makes selling weapons illegal and technically treason. After Ronald Reagan took office as president on January 20th, 1981, he vowed publicly to continue Carter's policy of blocking arms sales to Iran. And his justification was that Iran supports terrorism. However, a group of senior Reagan administration, and this is some of the documents we actually got from good old Ollie North, a group of senior Reagan administration officials in the senior interdepartmental group conducted a secret study in July in 1981, and their conclusion, this think tank, was that Iran would fall to the Soviets for support if we didn't sell them weapons. So in 83, the United States launched Operation Staunch, which was a very public diplomatic effort to persuade all other nations in the world not to sell arms or spare weapons parts to Iran. We were very public about this, went to the UN. Nobody's allowed to sell weapons to Iran, which is what makes what we did so fucking embarrassing. But what does any of that have to do with the Latin American drug trade, right? Why is this part of the podcast?
Oh, it all links, people. Just wait.
Yeah, I promise there's a reason. I'm not just on a soapbox for fun. That's a coincidence. But and the connection is at the same time that the American government's now considering their options on selling weapons to Iran, Contra militants based in Honduras are waging a guerrilla war to topple the Sandinista Liberation Front government in Nicaragua. Again, super complicated. All you need to know, the Contras were a super, super nationalistic right wing. These were Nazi-esque, American business-friendly enemy of the legitimate Sandinista government, which was socialist. See our problem here? If it's going to be against socialists, we will back literal Nazis to take them down. Guys who got a lot of business selling drugs to America. And Reagan hated these guys. The Reagan administration was just, again, the fight against socialism, the Cold War is hitting its apex, and we will not allow a socialist nation.
The Nicaraguan government, not the Contras, right?
No, so the Contras are the Nazis that are guerrilla warriors. They are, yeah. They're trying to attempt to take over. The Sandinistas are the legitimate elected government of Nicaragua.
The ones that you're saying Reagan hated, right? The Sandinistas?
Absolutely. Yeah, cool. And this is a long history. Yeah. And so, you know, from like the minute Reagan was in office, one of the major goals of the administration was to overthrow that left-wing Sandinista government in Nicaragua and to support these right-wing Contra rebels. But Congress was not into this Nazi shit at all. Direct U.S. funding to the Contras insurgency was made illegal through the Boland Amendment. And in violation of the Boland Amendment, Congress immediately sees what Reagan's up to. Reagan makes public support for this. And Congress is like, no, these Contras are just these are bad news. No, we're not doing this at all. And they actually make it a federal crime and treason to support these guys and fund them in any way. Right. And this is from Congress. They control all funding of the government. So anyway, Reagan's administration immediately violates the Boland Amendment in secret. The senior officials basically continue to secretly arm and train with CIA spooks, the Contras, and provide arms to Iran. And the operation was called the Enterprise. So basically, the Contras are heavily dependent on U.S. military and financial support. We are completely funding, training, and arming these guys to take out the Sandinistas. And the second Boland Amendment that Congress made totally threatens that. It's going to break the Contra movement. And it actually led President Reagan in 84 under the National Security Council. And his quote here, this is Reagan talking to the NSC. Keep the Contras together, body and soul, no matter what Congress voted for. That's what Reagan actually said, our president. That's a fucking quote from the sitting U.S. president telling the National Security Council to violate orders from Congress. Now, part of the sales also were an agreement to slowly release American hostages that had been taken by Hezbollah. And if you remember, again, Reagan first went on national television when this was first breaking and Ollie North was getting caught doing this, that his quote is, none of this money was ever, we were never exchanging money and arms for hostages. And then 1 week later, had to hop right back on national television once the evidence surfaced and had to basically say, we absolutely did that and I was totally lying to you. Had to admit it on air from the Oval Office. So what does that all wrap up to, right? What do we have? So the United States president violates his own executive order and a direct order of Congress to sell weapons to an enemy nation for hostages and money, and then uses that money to secretly and secondly illegally fund a fascist revolution of a peaceful socialist nation in South America. Even after all this has failed, the damage is done, and the CIA continued to shape politics in Latin America. That's history everyone knows. And part of that was opening up the American border for massive drug sales, making drug lords richer than ever and flooding the nation with narcotics that they then used to impose draconian prison sentences upon Americans. And this is why we go into that tangent, is because it's such a yarn ball.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
there's so many different moving parts to this. Mm-hmm. You have to kind of know where everything fits in. But like, this war on drugs was really a war on American people. Like, that's really who, especially the American poor and minorities. You 100% have to understand that first and foremost. Once you understand that, everything else that's going on makes 100% sense.
Yeah. And you know, it starts off as Nixon having a war on political opponents and black people. And then Reagan utilizes that to stir up dissent and rile up the American public to help continue this war on drugs. And then again, fund selling weapons to enemy nations and supporting fascist regime takeovers so that they can sell more drugs into the U.S. and promote American business and intelligence. Again, do I think Reagan drew all this up? Of course not. His vice president was the director of the CIA. Of course that's where this came from. This is the brainchild of Herbert Walker Bush, but Reagan signed off on it. And just as most of the sins of the W presidency definitely fall on Cheney, if you sign your name on it, you're at fault too.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. so that's through our Reagan. So that's where all this came from. So this idea of the war on drugs, is we talk about mass incarceration, documentaries like The 13th, you know, come to mind, and, you know, amazing books like The New Jim Crow spell this out for us. And where that's left us, and again, these are actually from Michelle Alexander. She's an ACLU lawyer and civil rights advocate. She's the one who published and wrote the book The New Jim Crow years ago. And it was the first true expose on this. Most people didn't connect the Iran-Contra, didn't connect Nixon, didn't connect the DARE program. She was the one who drew these pieces together, right? And what she's found, and again, her foundation, her work still tracks us to this day. And right now, the stats are, because of all of this, because of this war on drugs, and because we have definitely absolutely looked for a system that will incarcerate and destroy the lives of people of color, America is a pretty shitty place. The U.S. has our stats are the U.S. has over 2.4 million people behind bars. That's an increase of over 500% in the past 30 years. Think about that. Not by population. Those are raw numbers. It has just increased 500%. Our population has not. That is not per capita. And globally, we have 5% of the world's population. And you would think we'd have about 5% of the prisoners. We have 25% of its prisoners. That's it. A quarter of the world's prisoners are all in the United States, even though we only have 5% of the population. And then in there, 75% of the people who are in state prison for drug convictions are people of color. Although black people and white people sell and use drugs at the same rate. This has been found in every area of the country. Regardless of state, regardless of city, black people and white people sell, consume, and purchase drugs at the same rates, right? But in New York alone, 94% of people who are in prison for a drug offense are people of color. Over the last 20 years, state spending on prisons has grown 6 times higher than the spending increases on higher education. And this has led to a system where black people are arrested, put through this racist system, and churned out. And it is all because of this bullshit war on an adjective. And we don't see this in other countries, do we?
A couple more stats on that. Let me just give you some numbers for the minority thing. So black Americans are 4 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana charges than white peers. They make up nearly 30% of all drug-related arrests, despite accounting for only about 12.5% of all substance users. Obviously, some big disparities there. Black Americans are nearly 6 times more likely to be incarcerated for drug-related offenses than their white counterparts, despite equal substance usage rates. That's what you were talking about, Chris. Almost 80% of people serving time for a federal drug offense are black or Latino. And in state prisons, just to give you some more numbers on this, people of color make up 60% of those serving time for drug charges. Overall, this is nationwide.
And Chris was talking about a 2.5 million people in our prisons in the United States currently.
Yep.
So what that actually equals out to is 0.7% of the U.S. population. That's almost 1 whole percent. Almost.
Yeah.
And it doesn't just... 1 whole percent of the entire population of the United States is currently incarcerated.
Yeah.
Think about that, folks. That's a lot.
And it doesn't just stop there either. Like, it goes past just arrest too. In the federal system, the average black defendant convicted of a drug offense is going to serve nearly the same amount of time, roughly about, 60 months, as a white defendant would for violent crime. A black person gets busted for drugs, they're going to serve roughly about the same amount of time as a white guy that gets arrested for, murder, manslaughter, something like that.
Absolutely.
Ridiculous. People of color account for about 70% of all defendants convicted of charges with a mandatory minimum sentence. Going back to your mandatory sentencing there. Prosecutors are twice as likely to pursue a mandatory minimum sentence for a black defendant than a white defendant charged with the exact same offense. And black defendants are less likely to receive relief from mandatory minimums. So less likely to get off early and things like that. On average, the defendants are subject to mandatory minimums spend five times longer in prison than those convicted of other charges. Okay. Don't tell me that we don't have a problem with systemic racism. Just because these people aren't dropping N-bombs or going to Klan rallies doesn't mean they're not racist. They are part of this system. They are actively participating and engaging in these things. And this is what we're talking about when we mean systemic racism. And be wary of these facts, because people on the right will often challenge you and try to bait you and say, give me an example of systemic racism. This right here is a perfect example of what we're talking about. This is systemic. Just because you aren't a Klan member doesn't mean you can't be racist.
Well, and just because we have a war on drugs and that war on drugs is unjust doesn't mean that we actually don't have a problem with drugs in this country. We absolutely do. And in the United States, we have a horrible view on how to handle those people that do drugs. We love to put people in jail for doing drugs. So the question is does it work? Does putting people in jail for drugs work?
Well, yeah, and that's why no one does drugs.
Well, yeah, they go to jail, they get out, they're clean, there's no recidivism.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, that's not true.
Not at all. In fact, and I've got numbers on this too. Incarcerating people for drug-related offenses has actually been shown to have little to no impact on substance misuse rates. Instead,
of course it doesn't.
It's the opposite, actually. Incarceration is actually linked with increased mortality from overdoses. And in the first 2 weeks after their release from prison, individuals are almost 13 times more likely to die than the general population.
Yep.
Of course. So my question is what do we do to fix it? And there's something very interesting.
Longer sentences.
Longer sentences aren't going to do it at all.
Yeah, not quite working.
Oh, damn it. Sorry. I was hoping if we just kept at it, it would eventually work one day.
No. We tried that. It doesn't help. Here in the United States, we have a certain outlook on how we treat illicit drugs, right? So anybody that's found with any controlled substance, which that counts for any prescription medication that you weren't prescribed, or narcotic, or even up until very recently, the last 5 years or so, marijuana. Was illegal. And if you were carrying it, selling it, smoking it, injecting it, whatever the case may be, they were going to probably put you in jail for it. That is not how the entire world sees the problem of drug use. Becoming more and more common in a bunch of different countries to treat it more as a health issue than it is a criminal issue. Here in the United States, we have that very harsh look on the war on drugs, right? And they decided that they were going to put anybody who had any drugs on them or smoked any weed or did anything, they were going to put them in jail because that's where they needed to be because they were criminals. And that's how a majority of the world actually looked at it until approximately 20 years ago. So I'm going to talk about specifically Portugal, because I think they were probably one of the first countries that started out with a different idea. And that different idea was the decriminalization of illicit drug use back in 2001. So in the early 1990s, the population, 1% of the population of Portugal was addicted to heroin. Now, that's 1 in 100 people. And they found that they could very rarely find any families in Portugal that didn't have someone that was associated with that family that had a problem with specifically heroin. We're not talking about pot. We're not talking about the other drugs, although those are also been decriminalized. So back in 2001, they started what they called the drug strategy. And they decided instead of the tested strategy of criminalizing drug users and the population that like to use, you know, that use it recreationally, they were going to do something very different. They followed the science on this. Now, there was a whole bunch of medical professionals that they turned over this idea to, and they basically said, look, instead of putting these people in jail, what we need to do is help them. So we need to take away the stigma. We need to take away the reason for people wanting to use drugs, right? And that doesn't mean that all drug charges went away. No, they still put people in jail for trafficking drugs. So anything that's over what they would consider a usable amount in approximately 10 days. And those are specific to each type of drug, depending on how much you get to have on one's person.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but so the policy basically centered around for users taking the stigma off and focusing on treatment and refocusing police efforts on getting rid of the people distributing and importing. Is that correct?
No, it's not. So they weren't focusing on the people that were bringing the drugs in, although, I mean, obviously that's something that they still do, but they took away the need for the police to go and start looking at every individual as if they're a drug user. So you can walk into the police station. If you had a gram of coke in your pocket, you're not going to jail. Now, they may confiscate that gram of coke. They may assign for you to go to their specific commissions that deal with drug users, and you may be required to pay a small fine. Point is that it's not a criminal matter. It doesn't. You don't go to jail. You don't go in front of a judge. It's not put on your permanent criminal record. It is not considered a criminal issue. It's considered a health issue. In the early 1990s, they found all of these problems with drugs that were happening, and they decided to change how they were going to think about reacting to it. Okay, so they started all these drug outreach programs, had this radical idea of decriminalizing drugs and taking it away from the criminal system. So they don't have anybody, they have not in the last, 20 years, put anyone in jail for possession of illicit drugs for personal use. And I'm very specific about that because it is for personal use, not for trafficking. So large amounts of any drug, they're going to bust you for. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about an individual.
And I looked into it a little bit more. Basically, it's a whole idea of rethinking. It's this acceptance that there are people out there that are always going to use. And the best way to treat it is to take the stigma off it, give people a safe environment in which to use. So that, you know, in the case of heroin and things like that, you're not sharing needles, spreading things like hepatitis C, AIDS, things like that. So
HIV.
Yeah. And amazingly, when you do this, crime rates drop, deaths drop, the instances of these diseases drops, people start living happier lives, and you're able to treat drug addiction and people can actually get clean. Amazing, right?
So drug use overall has gone down. All right, so these numbers come from the EMCDDA, the Portugal Country Drug Report of 2017. So we're talking about marijuana, cocaine, and the use of prescription pills. So Portugal, for marijuana use, had 5.1% of the population. So our next was Britain at 11.3, France at 22.1, and then the Netherlands at 16.1.
That means that the second lowest of 11.3 from Britain, they were still half again as low. Current numbers. I mean, as current as we can really get, right? So, and then cocaine use. So in Portugal, it's 0.4% of the population uses cocaine. In Britain, that's 4%. That's an order of magnitude. That's a lot, just in percentage-wise. For France, they have a 2.4%, and the Netherlands of 3.6%. And we're not using the United States to compare, just because this is in the same region. Okay, wouldn't be fair to compare them to us here in the U.S. And then pill use, it's even crazier numbers, right? So pill use, prescription pill use, it's 0.6 for Portugal. For Britain, they use 3.1%, or 3.1% of the population uses prescription pills. France is 2.3%, and then the Netherlands is 6.6%. So again, an order of magnitude, 10 times the amount of people in the Netherlands use prescription pills than do in Portugal. Now, these numbers are far and away much lower than any other country in the surrounding area. And it's due to the fact that they have shifted away from incarceration and moved to the expansion of substance use disorder treatment. Okay, so what that means is that if a person is found with a small amount of illicit drugs for personal use, they can be fined, like I said before, and they will have to report to a commission within 3 days. And what happens during that commission is they're interviewed, they're talked to. The person can do one of two things. They can be referred to other services, such as psychological or drug treatment, or literally, they can walk out. And there's no marks against their criminal record. There's no reprise. Now, if within a certain amount of time, if they're found, if they're caught with drugs again and by a police officer, the fine goes up and they can be ordered to participate in drug treatment, things like that. But it's still not criminal. It's a health issue to them. That's the way they view this. They don't view it as a criminal issue. And that's the big difference between the way that we look at it here in the United States and the way that they look at it and the way that a lot of other countries like Mexico. Matt, who else did you say was also is starting to have the same outlook on drug use?
Just in doing this research, you know, there's 10 countries that have done something similar. I think Portugal by far has taken the biggest steps because they've done this as a country. But other countries have taken similar, not as far out there as Portugal has gone, but, you know, allowing small amounts of possession and things like that, decriminalizing. Ecuador, Uruguay, the Czech Republic, Switzerland, Croatia, Argentina, the Netherlands, Australia, and Mexico have all taken, you know, smaller steps along the same path that Portugal's already taken. Even here in the U.S., places to safely inject, needle centers and things like that are happening in like San Francisco, for instance. And the reason this is being done is because it just makes sense. Whether you're pro-drug or anti-drug, whatever, if the goal is to get less people using, lower crime rates, keep people out of prison, keep people from dying, those I'm assuming are the goal of the average person, regardless of which side of this argument you're on. I'm going to
How could it not be?
Yeah. And so if those are your goals, and this is kind of a similar approach that we take with like things like abortion and the weird stances that the right takes, but to not dive too into that, let's look at what our goals are. Let's look at what we're doing. If what we're doing is not achieving our goals, then we need to change what we're doing. Other countries have changed what they're doing, and what those changes have done is started to achieve these goals. Kay gave you guys the numbers on that, and that's kind of what we need to be doing. We need to rethink the way we treat these people because they are people. They're people in a health crisis. That's what they are. They're not criminals. Only reason they have suddenly become quote unquote criminals is because we've made what they're doing illegal. That's literally it. You know, just keep in mind, like tomorrow the U.S. could say that owning blue pants is illegal, and anybody owning blue pants would now be a criminal by definition.
legality has never been guide of morality. And we so often do that in conservative cultures, and especially America. We really like to hold the law up as this indivisible, perfect thing where disobeying the law, being a criminal, makes you some other lesser being. Let's remember, the Holocaust was legal. Slavery was legal. Jim Crow was legal. This war on drugs is legal. Just remember that legality has never equaled morality. It is not a barometer for it. In fact, it is often not. Legality and the criminal justice system exist to maintain the status quo and exist for the owners of property to control those without it. And if you need any proof of that, the fact that you can pay a fine to be relieved of a crime means that the law exists only to harm the poor, and the wealthy do not have to worry about it. Fines are evidence of this. And again, the fact that we can imprison, enslave, and kill people by the law shows that the law, legality, has nothing to do with justice or what's right.
Absolutely. I think a lot of us take a secular humanist approach to a lot of these things. And part of what that does, it involves treating people as humans and not as subhuman just because they broke a law that may or may not even be a moral one to begin with. You know what I mean? And that's how we have to start looking at these things. I don't think there's a single family in this country that hasn't been touched by this drug crisis. Again, we're not just talking about illegal drugs. The opioid crisis here in the U.S. is dealing with legal ones. It's an issue. Yeah. Well, and the people that are suffering from it the most are the ones on the right. Like, poor white people that traditionally vote conservatives have been the hardest hit by this opioid crisis.
Oh, the military, to be specific.
Yeah, that's true. Veterans have been taken down too.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, it speaks to my point. I can't imagine what they think of this. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's why most of them don't seek help, is they don't want to believe that they have a problem, because then all of a sudden they're a criminal and they don't want to face that, you know?
Well,
we have to take the stigma off. Well, that's just it. We have to take that stigma off. We have to let them know, like, we don't want them to be addicted or be abusing these drugs, because obviously down the line, this is something that could cause them to die or other health issues. But if we're automatically going to label them as a criminal or not human just for having a common issue, what's their motivation to ever try and get help?
There isn't any.
Exactly.
And that's also a reason why we have a huge problem in this country with alcoholism.
Oh, yeah.
Except alcoholism is legal.
It's the socially acceptable drug. And make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, alcohol is absolutely a drug. Just because it's socially acceptable and just because it's 100% legal if you're of age does not make it any less of a drug. In fact, in many cases, it's more dangerous than some of the drugs we've deemed illegal. Marijuana being the prime example of that. Now, I'm going to get a little out there here, but for those of you that don't know, there's a rating system for how we determine the severity of drugs. It's a scheduling system, and we call it Schedule 1 through 5. So if it's a Schedule 5 drug, it's probably the least harmful. You know, things like Tylenol and stuff would be like Schedule 5 drugs. Whereas Schedule 1 would be things that are up there as the most detrimental or harmful that can be possible. Marijuana, heroin,
morphine.
Actually, those are Schedule 2s.
Schedule 2s. I take that back. Morphine is Schedule 2.
Morphine is a Schedule 2. Heroin is a Schedule 1. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You may want to double check me on that, but I think I'm right. But you know what else is a Schedule 1? Marijuana. And not even because it's actually dangerous in any way, shape, or form. It's just because back in the day when paper moguls were being threatened by a new hemp that was a cheaper product, they lobbied against it to make it illegal. That's literally the only reason why marijuana became so illegal.
Yep.
But it just goes to show the insane way we look at drug use, drug treatment, the way we look at drug abusers. Like, it needs to change. Absolutely. We've got to get off this ridiculous mindset. You know, there's no reason why marijuana should even be on the schedule list when things like alcohol and tobacco aren't, because both of them kill more people on their own than marijuana does every single year.
And nicotine is actually more addictive than heroin. Now, it doesn't do as much damage to the body immediately as heroin, but it is more addictive.
It's actually not. It's actually not.
No, it absolutely is.
I'm just letting you know. I know what you're talking about. I've looked this up because I know it's a debate you've had with a couple of other friends, and I was curious when I heard it. First of all, you're measuring something, addictiveness. It's hard to quantify that, number one. Number two, when you're talking about more addictive, you're also got to have variance for people. So I looked at the studies you were talking about. The only thing that you can say is that it is at least as addicting. There's no way to determine which one is more or less. They are equal in terms of the studies that you're referencing. But that doesn't change the point. In fact, it actually kind of drives it home. This thing that we have that is completely legal that anybody can get quite easily is as addicting as something that we've deemed completely illegal and harmful and bad.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's no surprise that in the United States, this thing that George Washington, the founding father of the country, farmed is the most dangerous and terrible substance in the world because it served a private business interest. The war on drugs and drug enforcement has never been about public health or the public good.
No.
Not once, not ever. This is not about keeping kids safe. This is not about, you know, arresting criminals. This is about keeping a vicious cycle of imprisonment and oppression on minorities and convincing the public that things that are actually not all that much dangerous than the things we're allowed to consume are the worst substances in the world.
Yeah.
But if we accept the fact that just like with sex, this is something that human beings are going to do, and that the best way to make it so that there's a minimal collateral damage from them doing this is to treat it as a health crisis and still treat them as humans and treat it from a point of like what gets us the best results, maybe that's the better way to go.
Yeah. And again, it's the best way to go is to be honest about this, to not put forth more draconian measures, to not ever everyone be tougher and tougher on crime or more lenient on crime. As Americans need to do this, we need to talk about where this came from, what it fueled, and where it's taken us. In South Africa, after apartheid ended, they had something called Truth and Reconciliation. And what this was is, you know, again, apartheid is its own podcast we could do. But after apartheid is over, which was kind of a halfway between slavery and Jim Crow, they basically told everyone who was part of this system that they could be pardoned. If you were part of this governmental bureaucracy that killed, tortured, treated people of color like a second-class citizen and carried forth all these abuses, if you came forward and admitted all of it on the record for posterity, you could be forgiven. And the reason Nelson Mandela did this wasn't because he wanted to read a bunch of shit. It was because you cannot have reconciliation until you have truth. Everything needs to be out there in the air. You have to air your dirty laundry. You have to get it out there. And that's when you can move forward. But if you don't, again, which is part of the reason America is suffering from this, because we refuse to acknowledge as an entire society what we did with slavery, what we did with Jim Crow. We don't want to acknowledge it. We talk about it and we go, yep, it was terrible, but everything's fixed now. It's like, no, we never had that truth and reconciliation. And that's why that nation is miles ahead of us and why they have gotten more leaps and bounds towards civil liberties in a pace that we could never have. Don't get me wrong. South Africa still got some serious problems, especially with their police force. But the amount of progress they've made in such a short time is inspiring. And again, you can directly thank Nelson Mandela for that. But that's what you need. And until we need Americans to have these conversations, and everyone needs to know where the war on drugs came from and what it's doing to us. Because if it's based on racism, based on lies, and it continues to be a tool of the oppressor, it cannot be reformed. It must be dismantled.
Absolutely. And Chris is right. The way we start is by taking a big old mirror to ourselves and realizing we are not the prettiest country on the block. In fact, far from it. We've got some of the most scars and dirt on our face of any of the ones out there, more so because we've been so prominent in abusing our privilege for so long on the world stage, you know, not just here at home.
Yeah.
Again, that's, I think, all we can really say on this. And everyone needs to get comfortable with this. It's not a comfortable topic. So speaking of what's going on in the world of social interaction, Matt.
So a lot. As you guys know, last week we lost the last half of our audio. So all the shout outs for that week were pretty much gone. So we've got all the ones from last week that didn't get out. And we've got all the ones from this week that we would normally do. We've got a lot of things to go over. So the first thing I want to hit on, and I'm going to do a quick apology here. A little background for those of you that are unfamiliar with the podcasting world. Apple Podcasts is one of the biggest platforms out there. And for some weird reason, probably because Apple's awful and it sucks. And if you have an iPhone, I'm glad you're happy with it, but it's awful and Apple sucks. They do not give us a lot of resources to interact with our audience. They also don't have any way of notifying us when we get reviews or responses. So the only way I was ever even able to find out that we had people reviewing us on Apple Podcasts was to literally log into my own personal iTunes account, search for the Alt Left Podcast, find the Alt Left Podcast page, and click reviews. And that was literally the only way I could see it. So we've got a couple of reviews that were a little bit more lengthy that I want to get into.
So if you could, I'm sorry, I was so lost on that. What was that process again for leaving us reviews on iTunes? Because that would be great if our listeners could all hop onto iTunes and leave us some reviews. That would be a very nice Merry Christmas for us.
Absolutely. You know, these podcasts grow by reviews, and iTunes is actually one of the biggest, if not the biggest platform out there. And the more reviews, 5-star ratings we get, the more we go up in the rankings and the more people will hear us. So if you love this show and you want to give us a review and a 5-star rating, we'd really appreciate it. It's also another way that you can talk to us in addition to like social media and things like that. It's absolutely a big help. So if you guys want to do that, we'd appreciate it. But we have three ones that I want to get to. So the first one, I'll start from the earliest one. This is from back in December 10th. This is somebody commenting on our third episode. Their name is The Bustinator. So this is from The Bustinator.
I love that. I love that name, by the way.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. Not bad, right? Gave us 5 stars, said these guys are doing surprisingly well for only 3 episodes. Witty content, not too much banter for randos, and they keep the pace. Keep it up. Thank you, The Bustinator. That was really nice.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you doing that. Don't worry. The money I sent you is coming.
The next one is a little bit more recent. This is from back in January 15th. This is from Mama Labs. I'm guessing it's a mom with a bunch of Labradors by the name.
A laboratory where they're fabricating mamas.
Let's go with yours. I like that better. 5 stars, says super amazing podcast with the best hosts. Highly, highly recommend. Well, thank you, Mama Labs.
That tickled me right in the heart. Right? That's very sweet.
Yeah, I'm verklempt.
Yeah. And this last one is from February 4th. I am going to butcher this name. And this is one of the ones that we did last week, and I couldn't get it then. I'm not going to get it now. I'm going to take a shot. Vila Kuse, I think is how they say their name. 5 stars. They say, educated, factual, and easy to listen to. You can't beat it. Thank you so much.
I'm really glad they said educated before we butchered their name.
Right, I know.
and I'm very sorry if we did butcher your name. We're just 3 monolingual dumb Americans. We're really sorry. We're just so white.
They said educated, not eloquent.
Touche, sir. Touche.
The next one is from our Carolinas crew, the Big 3.
Woo!
Yeah, so we've got 3 people. One of them we've done shout-outs a lot for is Basehead Faye. She's the one whose husband recently recovered from COVID. Yeah, by the time this airs, he should be recovered.
We covered that, but we've all been praying to the spaghetti monster that Mr. Basehead Fade comes through all right.
Ramen. But yeah, so there's actually 3 of them. I mean, her husband, I think, is a listener as well. But there's a group. There's TD Gamer. All right. There's Basehead Faye, and then Bearded Cynic. Okay, these are the 3. They're the ones that gave us the boost in numbers from, I believe it was North Carolina or South Carolina. I can't remember off the top of my head now.
It was North Carolina.
So these are our North Carolina peeps. We were just interacting in our DMs. She was telling us a little bit about how they found us. And so it was her boy, TD Gamer, found us and recommended us because he liked our little friend group, said we reminded them of them. TD Gamer is apparently the K of their group.
Yeah, every group's got to have one.
Right on, TD.
Yep, yep. She's the progressive, and I think she falls in line with me because I'm not going to lie. When she mentioned that Bearded Cynic was the super left commie of the group, I had to take a shot over into his Twitter profile. No lie, you guys saw the screenshot. This guy could be Chris's brother. Bald head.
Or body double. I mean,
something.
Jesus.
Tatted up, bald head, beard, big old burly looking dude with like communist love. I'm telling you, these guys could absolutely be twins in my book. Yeah,
if I just step up my beard XP, I could look just like this guy. Shout out to Bearded Cynic. I must know the bearded ways because I've seen your picture. I'm impressed. I covet a beard that thick. But yeah, I saw that picture, and I mean, the first thing I did was I had a very uncomfortable conversation with my mother about what she was doing that year.
But yes, these guys are a great group. They are constantly engaging with us on Twitter, constantly retweeting us, blowing us up. I have to say, if we're getting new users, probably at least half of them are coming from these guys. So much love to our North Carolina peeps. TD Gamer, Basehead Faye, and Bearded Cynic. Love you guys.
I absolutely. Thanks very
next
much.
Next time guys. I head to Asheville, I'll have to go out and buy them all a beer.
Absolutely.
Basehead Faye, I still haven't heard from the lawyers.
She'll know what that means. I wanted to give our listeners an opportunity to ask us questions directly, which is why we've gotten so much feedback. So we've got two that came on Instagram. One is from Xmas Monkey. This is a little bit long, so bear with me. I'll try to take this nice and easy. Hey guys, love the podcast and listen each week. I just wanted to say that a great way to help our communities is finding a local mutual aid coalition to either donate to or volunteer for. Generally, mutual aids care for the local unhoused population, which is also associated with communities that have been ravaged by the war on drugs. Most of the ones I have seen and supported are left-sided and believe in BLM, socialistic medicine, and things like that. Some of them even have monthly tiers. I personally recommend, and she gives us two @s here on Instagram, @thepeoplescoalition_4, @thepeoplescoalition_4, and @714mutualaid for Orange County.
And we'll link to those below.
We will. These are two, I think, Orange County groups. And she says, thanks. So thank you very much, Xmas Monkey. We really appreciate it. For our listeners, that's a good little bit of information for you out there. And we'll absolutely link to these things in our description for this episode. The last one comes from a previous shout out we did. This is on Instagram. He did a Twitter shout out to us early on when we first started doing shout outs. This is from Stuffy25. Love the podcast and so glad I found you guys on Twitter. Outside of politics, what are some other interests you guys have? You had mentioned tabletop board games, RPGs, etc. I've really wanted to try out Pathfinder, but my friends and I are waiting until after the pandemic. Keep up the great work. So I'm going to kick it over to Kay to start us off with that one.
Well, I mean, I play a lot with computers and not computer games necessarily. I've always enjoyed technology, all that kind of stuff. I like to fix things. I have a 3D printer that I play with often. It is constantly in pieces. So you probably can guess how often it actually works. But it's the joy of taking it apart and putting it back together that that really does it for me. And then, you know, as far as like other games, we were playing a whole lot of Magic right before pandemic happened and we stopped actually like physically seeing each other. And then there was
Magic the Gathering card game for those.
Yeah, Magic the Gathering card. And then, you know, we actually often met and played some sort of RPG game, Pathfinder being absolutely one of them. My specific favorite would be White Wolf's Vampire. That was the first game that I ever played, you know, 20 years ago, you know, being a late teen, being, you know, 18, 19 years old. And it persists as being probably one of the best, in my opinion.
For me, I am into, like Kay, I also am big into computers. I built my own system here. I like to regularly build and upgrade new systems. It's just kind of a habit of mine. Specifically though, mine is more gaming oriented. I do love gaming of all kinds, console, PC, you name it, whatever. Right now, the game I'm currently into the most is Red Dead Redemption Online. It's a great little game. It was recently for $5 on Steam. I don't know if that's still going on or not, but it was so worth it. So glad I got it. I got into gaming with these guys. Actually, Chris is currently getting us ready for a D&D session once we open back up after COVID. He's got a game he started way back when, and we're going to pick it back up. So I'm pretty excited for that as well. Magic the Gathering, pretty much anything that could be considered nerd genre, all of us are into on some level. Comic books, superheroes, movies, TV, you name it, we're probably into it. So if anybody ever wants to hit us up about those things, feel free. Chris, what about you?
I mean, again, you know, there's a reason the three of us have been friends for quite a long time. We have a lot of similar interests. So my first and foremost love is actually always going to be politics. It's what I'm here for. You know, I'm finishing my BA in history right now. I'm moving into grad school. Social welfare and politics are just my jam. It's what I'm always going to be passionate about. In terms of my nerd flag, yes, I am a huge gamer, huge RPG fan when it comes to video games. You know, my favorites of all time are Skyrim, Mass Effect, Fallout. These are my yes. go-tos. I literally, my Xbox in my bedroom is just my Skyrim machine. That's all it is. It is my Skyrim machine. And I have it on my PC because some jerk named Matt helped me build a rig because I don't know anything about hardware. I can port forward your router with my pinky broken and my eyes closed. But man, you want me to put a motherboard in and I am a monkey hitting a rock into an oyster. So thank God for this guy. But anyway, I have recently this last year gotten into PC gaming. I'm actually huge into Star Trek Online, as old as that is. I've been playing that for about a year. I just recently, Matt and I, actually Kay tried out to have gotten into Red Dead Redemption 2 online. So yeah, I've been playing a whole lot of that. And yes, my number one nerd love beyond gaming, though, is going to be gaming. Tabletop RPGs is where it is at. I discovered that right after high school. Fell in love with everything. Pathfinder, by the way, I do recommend. It's a very good system. It's much better than Dungeons & Dragons 3.0 or 3.5. However, or 4.0, I mean. However, D&D 5e is better than Pathfinder. It is streamlined. True. It is all about storytelling. You don't have to be some nerd crunching numbers for 3 hours to make sure you get this exact perfect progression. Nope. It's all about telling a good story and having a great time. And
D&D Beyond makes it so easy to build.
Yep.
So easy. D&DBeyond.com
online is an amazing resource. They have interactive character sheets and books and all kinds of resources. Check it out.
Yep. And so I think D&D 5e is great. I'm actually always, though, going to be a number one White Wolf fanboy. And I do not like Requiem, and I do not like 5th edition. I'm a purist. I like Revised in V20. I will always love the 20th anniversary of Vampire, Mage, Werewolf. I will always be a fan of that 20th anniversary saga.
That's because V20 is where it's at.
It is. And my friend Drew and I are kind of the two forever DMs in our group. So we kind of trade back and forth on who's DMing the game. But yeah, we play White Wolf, we play D&D, we play anything we can get our hands on that's good. We've done all kinds of
Star Wars games, too. That Star Wars game Drew ran was really fun.
We played a Crimson Skies game, which is a board game that was based off of a video game. It was fantastic. So anyway, yes, I am a giant gaming nerd, and that's my life. It is politics, academia, and RPGs. That's all I care about.
Right on. So that pretty much ends our shout outs for this week. Thank you, as always, to everyone that's interacting with us. I mean, honestly, you guys are making this worth it. The conversations we've been having in the groups that we're in amongst each other that this podcast has started have just been phenomenal. The North Carolina people, the ones in our progressive groups, even the ones in our podcasting groups, everyone has just been really great. We're developing this small little community of ours, and I just can't thank everyone enough. It's been great. Keep it up.
Yeah, and reach Absolutely. Out as often as you like. I don't care if you've talked to us before. Our Instagram and Twitter and Facebook are there. Matt is super bored. He has nothing to do. He doesn't have a family or a job. He literally just sits at home.
No wife, no yeah. children.
He has a printed picture of the podcast logo, and he sits in a corner rocking back and forth holding it. And so please hit it up. Let him get back to you. He has nothing to do. I don't care if you're divorced. Hit us up. Talk to us. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't. Chat with us. But thank you for sitting through this with us, guys. You are amazing. We love you. And until next week, when you let us into your ear holes next Monday, take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. And remember, the revolution is you.